tonight on Arena. Sheena Lambert on her new film, Boccia, and Waterford band The Ran play live in studio. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. A new film set in rural Ireland in the 1970s is set to premiere at this year's Galway Film Fla. Based on the novel The Lake by Sheena Lambert, Boccia tells the story of a village which was once flooded to make a reservoir purely to keep water for the people of Dublin. The secrets that were supposedly submerged under the lake are all part of this, and how sometimes those secrets have a habit of floating to the surface once again. Sheena Lambert is with me in studio this evening. She wrote the screenplay of her own novel. Fáilte roth, agus gur míle maith agat as bhea an seo.
Gur míle maith agat, fáilte roth.
Because this is an Irish language version of your novel. The novel was The Lake in English.
Yes.
And then you decided, I'm not only going to have this in Irish, but I'm going to adapt it into a screenplay.
Into a screenplay. Crazy idea, yeah. But yeah.
So, well, maybe if we start with what set you to write the novel?
For sure. Well, I started researching the lake more than 10 years ago now. I was a little bit obsessed with the Pullafuca Reservoir and the Blessington Lakes and the stories, and like I'd read books about it, but the stories of the villages that are their village that is drowned, as it were, under the lake. And
You had a background in engineering, hadn't
I do,
you?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm an engineer and worked as an engineer before I started writing. And so I suppose I had some element of interest in the hydroelectric power system and all that, and the building of the dam. And my father's a civil engineer, so I was interested in it from that point of view. But it's very hard not to get really sucked into the stories behind the people who were the washed outs, they call them, literally, that had to leave their villages, their homes and their farms and their businesses, and with some meagre payment by all accounts from the government, just off they go and try and make a life somewhere else so that this big dam would be built and the valley flooded.
That's a very interesting term, isn't
it?
The washed outs.
Yeah.
Because the suggestion in that term is that they were washed out, as opposed to they were forced out by the presence of the water.
Well, the reality is a lot of them would have been, you know, in the middle of their lives, and it's very difficult back then. They were talking about a lot of these dams were built across the world, not just in Ireland, but in the 1940s and 50s, post-Second World War. And, you know, you really were sort of maybe at that stage in your life where it was a bit late to go starting again, whereas nowadays maybe we wouldn't be so, you know, challenged by it. But certainly it was a challenge for people, and it was very interesting to me. And obviously all the you know, the nitty gritty and the moving of graves and cemeteries and all this kind of stuff was interesting. But I suppose I was very much interested when I was writing the book on maybe what the next generation would suffer as a result of that, you know, massive impact on their lives. So their parents maybe, or their grandparents that had to, they were the washed outs. But the next generation often, you know, have to deal with the fallout from those scenarios.
Some of the families that stayed then and maybe moved just a few miles down the road, or were just outside the area that was flooded.
They were left
within the community. And this, I think, is where the principal character of the novel, I'm guessing, and certainly of the film, or one of the principal characters of the film, Peggy Casey, played by Eleanor O'Brien, I think she was important to you in the telling of this story.
Very important. I mean, when you're writing a book, and it's the same writing scripts, but when I was writing this book, it's usually like a confluence of different ideas that suddenly come together and you go, oh, now I have something I can really write about. So I remember I was down in Kilmacalogue in Kerry, and there's this really cool old pub on the coast there. A lot of divers actually go for their lunch there. You know, it's that sort of a place. But I remember watching one of the girls behind the bar and thinking, you know, she really was in charge of the place, you know, and you know, she started me thinking about this character, and then setting it in that era obviously worked in terms of the lake, but also was such an interesting time for women, because there was a real women's lib.
Yeah, so we should just to be clear on it, the character of Eleanor is then this second generation. So she's
That's
in the 1970s.
That's right.
Looking back at the flooding, or certainly part of the after 20 effect.
20 odd years previously. Yeah. And the story, both in the book and the film, is set over the weekend of the All-Ireland football final. So it's literally the last weekend in September in 1975. And it's all based in, you know, there's a lot of truth in it. There was a drought that year. There was, so all those lakes, the levels of them were very low. So we're, you know, anyway, this character.
And that dropping of levels means that things
secrets
start
are
to
revealed for
come
sure
up to the surface.
For sure, yeah. But yeah, but Peggy is, I hope, a great character. I mean, Eleanor did a super job playing her in the film, and you know, I think it was exciting to write somebody like her who's in her early 20s, but she's running this business. She's making a super job of it. She's you know, well able to manage the locals and the drunks and the lads who are in and all the messing that goes on in a rural pub. But she's also, you know, serving food, which was like, you know,
in 1970s.
Exactly. So, you know, she's a great character. She was a great character to write, and I hope she comes across. Yeah. I think she's great in the movie.
Let's have a listen to a scene. This is quite early on, so yes, there's hardly any secret that it's a body that gets washed up quite early on in the film. And here we have Mo Dunford, who's the Jackeen detective down the country now, doing the investigating here, Detective Ryan, and he's in the pub with the proprietor, Peggy Casey, played by Eleanor O'Brien. And in the midst of this, also we'll hear the voice of Pádraig O'Lynshy as Coleman, who remembers back to the time, he remembers well the flooding that actually happened.
You can stay pathologist, I'm sure. A madam can screw the ear of us in of a second shape here.
Looking for? V. Doc, dear, okay, grog or corpon general again. Look out, Doc.
A doors, ma. How many of the Gahrind and Inkish terms, sir? The 18 inch of tub. Nah, Kurt, that's a shamble like it all.
There we had the voice of Pádraig O'Lynshy, the final voice there, remembering back, saying, "Oh no, that wasn't a body from the graveyard," which is a kind of a bit of a hint for us as to where the story is going to go a little bit later on. And we also heard the voices of Mo Dunford as Detective Ryan, Peggy Casey as Eleanor O'Brien. This is from the film Botcha, screenplay by Sheena Lambert, developed from her own novel, The Lake, and now part of the Cine Cahir project and opening at the Galway Film Fair. It must be great to be getting it down to the Galway Film Fair. Is that the first outing in a public, kind of public screening for you, Sheena?
Yeah. It's the first screening of the movie, so it was absolutely fantastic to have its technically world premiere, I suppose, in Galway. No better place. I mean, it's filmed in Galway. It's set in Galway. It's half of the cast and crew are from Galway. The producers are from Galway. Both my parents are from Galway. We were so lucky to have Eimear Noonan.
So there are some Galway. She does the music. I saw that.
She's a Galway girl. So yeah, we really went the whole hog with the Galway. So it'll be. It's certainly my first screening. Personally as well, so it's super exciting.
Must be very exciting indeed. Now I'll come back a little bit to now Ken for a Roche or Inchin Agadeshin, you have Togelega, Augusta Togelega, the Hishmori,
Mawami, Sas Kunamara Mawami, Agus, Drastal Misha, Skull. Imalia Clea now, Ascailga, so Glossy's gone. So, Skulkina actually are Rastal Cullum Barade. Another Sinecahar alum. Vian Larish Grief Agam Amerla, obviously, but August Vishir Intanagam, Visimagam Ashtru. Bajer Scanon Bajer Shatelafisha near McKinchy Ags Vima Kinchle Shivani Goira as Danu Media Agus Agusin Honig on Desh Sinecahar, so it's just Aganam Kiena Agus Kapmer, you know what? Vexha Shogahintok, the Murdegra Simakuan, Agus
V.
books, did you? Yeah.
And what Cine Cahir have done, you mentioned Colleen Kuhn there and Colum Barade, that was part of that. Arocht was part of the Cine Cahir. Yeah. Roche August, Frank August Roche.
That's right. Freywica, you know, more recently, another brilliant one. Yeah. It's just been such an amazing scheme. It's one of those, like, it's just such a success story, I think. I'm passionate about more Irish television, more Irish.
Yeah. You had worked on Ross na Rún as well.
No, I didn't. I have other projects, Ascailge, and TV projects and, potentially film projects. But it's definitely something I feel like we should be, like, Cine Cahir is absolutely phenomenal and Screen Ireland have been phenomenal as well as TG Cahir and Commissioner Mann. But, I mean, I think we should be breaking out from Cine Cahir at this point. And certainly in terms of TV, there's such an opportunity there to be producing Irish language television, and, you know, not just for an Irish audience. You know, we're all so well able to watch Scandi Noirs and every other. I mean, some of the best movies or TV shows I've watched recently have been French or, you know, Japanese or Korean or whatever, and no one bats an eyelid anymore. So we should be absolutely, I think, breaking through those barriers and making contemporary Irish language, because there's so many people speaking Irish, you know,
because of the Gaelscoil movement,
saying,
as much
east
as anything
of the Shannon, yes. Not all west of the Shannon, although, you know, and I've half my family live west of the Shannon and Connemara, so I, you know, obviously they're there too, for sure, but there's such a fantastic opportunity to write and produce and make Irish language shows now. I think I hope we don't waste it.
And as you say, I mean, no matter how rudimentary your Irish is, there'll always be a couple of fuckle there, and you'll recognise some phrases and things, and you'll pick up others 100%. As you go along. And we'll happily read subtitles under French, German, Korean, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So we can do it. We can do it under Irish without any difficulty either. But there is that other translation, and I'm quite interested in the translation from novel to screen. I mean, you've mentioned that character of Peggy Casey, the proprietor of the pub, played by Eleanor O'Brien here. When you see what you've imagined on a page, and you can write all sorts of things on a page, but when you see it embodied, and when you're giving words to the character to just say on the screen, how different a process was that?
Oh, it was absolutely a challenge. I've said it before, and I think I'll say it again. I don't know if I'd ever adapt one of my own novels. I've written a couple of novels. This is the only one I've ever adapted. I'm not sure I'd ever adapt another one.
Right, why not?
I think adapting someone else's work is difficult enough. But, you know, I've likened it to, you know, I used to be a knitter, and I feel like, you know, you'd knit this intricate jumper, and then you'd go, like, and that's the book. But then you'd literally watch yourself as you unpick every stitch and try and knit a same but different jumper. But you know what? It's such a different process, but it's such a collaborative process. It's so different. Writing novels is so solitary. I absolutely love playwriting and theatre and screenwriting, because you've so many people involved. They're, as you say, like, bringing your crazy thoughts you had in your head 12 years ago, like, to life is just, it's such a gift. And Ruan McGann, the director, did such a super job of, like, it is a process, and sometimes it's a testy process, because I have, you know, ideas of how I feel something should be, and then he'll have ideas of how he feels it should be, and of course the producer has ideas, and but you know what, it's much easier
when it's a book. You write it down.
I actually think it was such a lovely experience. Everybody on board, and even, like, when it comes to, we talked about makeup and hair and all of those things, the production design, Connor Dennison did a super job. It's so amazing to see what you had in your head come to life. It's an absolute gift.
And I guess there were moments, I'm sure, when you had to lose bits of the book that must have been so difficult. But then you were getting so much extra from the all that input from your collaborators.
For sure. And I think, you know, with the book, it's very much about, when you're adapting a book, I think you have to almost, like, it's the same story, but it may be told in a completely different way. Mm. So I think you really have to find the essence of the book and then start from that when you're looking at writing it as a screenplay, whether for stage or for screen. And, you know, I was blessed because Screen Ireland and Cine Cahir, you know, are very supportive. And I had an amazing script editor, Aideen McCarthy right at the beginning. So when I was tearing my hair out, she was just keeping me really calm. And it was just she was a fantastic addition to the whole team as well. So, you know, it was difficult for sure, but I hope it's, you know, I hope it's a success. Yeah. I feel it is. I think it's a beautiful film to look at.
Beautifully shot in that regard, no doubt about that. Where was it shot, by the way?
Well, Galway, surprise.
Sure. Why did I even ask?
Very handy for me. I stayed with my cousin, Joseph Ridge, down the road from the pub that they commandeered as Casey's Tea Casey. So yeah, we had some fun.
Yeah. And the other aspect is there are these two time frames. We have the story from the 1950s and we have the contemporary story, if you like, which is the 1970s, which is the present moment of the film itself. Realising that when you're writing a novel, it's grand. You just put, you know, 1970, or you put 1950 at the top of the page and you go and you write your chapter.
Yeah.
Different when it comes to the screenplay and to realising a screenplay.
For sure. And definitely something that we discussed to and fro in early, you know, stages of development of the script. And certainly I think there were people on the team who thought, you know what, we don't need flashbacks. And then others who thought we do, you know. Yeah. So actually, you know, I think it's worked really well. Again, it's a really testament to the team involved between hair and makeup and everything else that it was just, it looks so good, I think, and it's worked so well. But it was a challenge, but I think I think it looks beautiful, and it's really broad. It's really worked for the story, but it's worked visually as well, which is what you're always worried about, that it mightn't work.
Yeah, one of the things that particularly impressed me, Pádraic Ó Lintshe, who we heard in our first clip playing the character of Coleman in 1970 something, and then there's the flashback to the 1950s, and Coleman is there as a young man, and I was looking thinking, is that still Pádraic Ó Lintshe? Yeah. Is that still, looks very like him.
Yeah, yeah.
He's not as haggard looking as he is in the 1975s. And it is him. And I've waited for the credits at the end, and I wanted to check with you when you came in today to be absolutely certain. But it is him. Let's listen to him in a scene from back in that earlier part of the story, if you like. And there's a young woman called Bernadette Murphy in this clip, played by Juliette Crosby, from that earlier section. And Pádraic Ó Lintshe, once again, is Coleman. The much younger Coleman. And you can hear there's a little bit of something going on between the two of them.
Oh, got all another Bernadette.
And what to skeleton, Coleman?
I'm on the corner here, Fad Loffa.
Bernadette Murphy. Pick Massago down tomorrow.
Coleman, I go with Chet Conan Orchard, he this in air, so the dagger until I. I take it, Andrehid. Gachrod.
Boom.
Dublin Jackins.
Huh, Coleman?
Come out here and go so as Kakoi Gola.
What are you doing there, Nicholas?
Peter, go in. August, Peter, Nachul.
It was a big fun.
There you go. That's a scene from the earlier part of the film, Bocce, Sheena Lambert, screenwriter and writer of the novel on which the film is based, is with me in studio this evening. We heard Bernadette Murphy there, played by Juliette Crosby, and Pádraic Ó Lintshe as the young Coleman. We heard the graves being, that's what's happening there. The bodies had to be moved in order for the valley to be flooded, which was quite a common occurrence.
Absolutely.
Around the world, Sheena.
Yeah,
at that
and around
time.
Ireland, even some of the other, like in Ishkara and in on the Shannon, where there were similar hydroelectric power, like the dams being built. Sometimes there weren't always villages that were drowned, but very often there were cemeteries, and they literally had to move each grave one by one and reallocate them. Relocate them rather further up, you know, usually further up the hill. So certainly not a nice job, but they caught it. It's a great scene in the movie,
well captured indeed. Listen, Cogorgicus, Asan Lauer, August Asan Scanon, I was going to Gnairi live in Aliv, on Vish Shakuin,
on Niula Dool.
Gormil Mahagut, Bocce, Shizan Shaitanaman Athar on Scanon. Bocce is the film we've been speaking about. It's by Danu Production. Screenplay by Sheena Lambert, based on her own novel, directed by Ruan McGann. It will be at the Galway Film Flat on Wednesday, July the 9th, as Sheena was just telling us there, 7 p.m. And you can get full details on galwayfilmfla.com. com. Now, last week, you may remember that I spoke with the writer and director, Laura Piani, about her new feature film, which is called Jane Austen Wrecked My Life. Laura's former place of work was the Parisian bookshop Shakespeare and Company, and it features prominently in the film. The heroine in the film, Agathe, works there. Today, the 16th of June, is, of course, Bloomsday. And as many of you will know, after Ulysses was serialised between 1918 and 1920, it was published in full for the first time by the owner of Shakespeare and Company, Sylvia Beach. Here, now, on Bloomsday, is a clip taken from the RTE archive. In 1962, Niall Sheridan spoke to Sylvia Beach as part of a series called Self-Portrait. Beach went into great detail about how she came to meet James Joyce and publish his book in 1922.
Well, I opened my bookshop and already I had all these young Americans who were pouring into Paris from America, and they were disgusted in America because they couldn't get drink, it was prohibition, and they couldn't get Ulysses. I used to think those were the two causes of their discontent. They were thoroughly frustrated. And of course, Ulysses was the work that they were all, they admired the most. And think how annoying not to be able to get it anymore. And it was being suppressed in a review called The Little Review. And two women there, it was always women who were publishing Joyce, and they were trying to publish this thing, and it was suppressed. And finally their review was suppressed and they were hauled off to prison for it.
Well, suddenly,
all on account of Joyce.
Suddenly you, from being a bookseller, a very famous bookseller, you suddenly decided to go into publishing.
Yes. You see, I met Joyce one day at a party that I wasn't supposed to attend at all, as I wasn't invited. But Adrienne Monnier took me. And it was the house of a French poet named André Speer, who was a friend of Ezra Pound's. And Ezra Pound had just lured Joyce and his family to Paris, and he had had him invited to this party. And so we were really both of us uninvited. And when I got there, the host, André Speer, whispered in my ear, the Irish writer James Joyce is here. So, you see, he must have known already the importance of James Joyce. And I was so frightened, so scared, and I imagined Joyce up in the clouds somewhere with the gods, you see. I never thought I could meet him in the flesh, and it seemed terribly frightening. And I thought at first I would run home, but I didn't. I stayed, and I met Joyce, and Mrs. Joyce was there. I met Nora Joyce and liked her very much. And Joyce was sitting at table, and Ezra Pound was teasing him with putting all the wine bottles and all the glasses in front of his place, and he wasn't drinking a drop. And this was because he had vowed not to drink until nighttime. But Ezra knew this. Nobody else could understand the point of that joke. And after lunch, when they were discussing all kinds of problems in French writing, I went into a room off the dining room where André Speer had a lot of books piled up. It was his little library. And leaning in the corner against the bookshelves was James Joyce, drooping. And I went up to him boldly and spoke to him, and we had a conversation together. And he seemed very much interested in my bookshop. He said, "What do you do?" And I said, "I have a bookshop." "Oh, what have you? Give me the address." And I told him, "It's Shakespeare and Company, and it's 8 Rue du Puitrin, Paris 6. And he took this all down, peering very close at it, because his eyes were not good. And I was very much impressed with Joyce. I thought I'd never seen anyone so interesting and so fine. He seemed very sensitive, terribly, and very, very interesting. And some people ask me, "Were you disappointed when you met James Joyce?" And I always say, "Never at all," for he was anything but disappointing.
And then he brought along the manuscript, the typescript of Ulysses to you.
Yes. Well, he used to tell me about what was going on in New York, and he was following this case where the Ulysses was being suppressed. And finally he came one day to show me this little review, and he said, "You see, this is now being completely suppressed, and my book," as he pronounced it, "will never come out." So he sat there with his head in his hands, and I said to him, "Would you like me to publish Ulysses?" And he said, "I would." He was seemed very much relieved, in fact. Why, I don't know, because it wouldn't inspire confidence in anyone who had such a book that he'd taken 7 years to write, to give it into the hands of someone so inexperienced and young and just a kind of a little bookshop, not a publishing house at all.
What an amazing woman. Sylvia Beach there, the woman who first the owner of Shakespeare and Company, the bookshop in Paris, of course, and the woman who published the first edition of Joyce's Ulysses in 1922. Lots of Ulysses stuff to be found on rte.ie/culture, including a piece on the first ever Bloomsday. And you'll find a video version of that Sylvia Beach clip within that extraordinary, as I say. And for those of you interested in hearing the full of Joyce's Ulysses, the famous RTE Radio Éireann Players version of the full text of Ulysses, started this morning at 8 a.m. on Radio 1 Extra, and it will continue through the night, I do believe, before we get to the final yes of Molly's soliloquy. You can check out at some other time, not now, where they are in that particular progress through the voice or through the book Ulysses. Hailing from the Cumara Mountains in County Waterford, the Ran are made up of four brothers, Tommy, Danny, Sean and Stephen Dunford. Rooted in family, folklore and the music of their upbringing, the band has already earned a spot at two festivals this summer. Tunefest in Dungarvan, where they'll take to the stage in their hometown, and Glastonbury, one of the most iconic music festivals in the world. Delighted that all four Dunford brothers are with me in studio now, and they're going to start with a tune called Seafin. Thank you. There we have it. Sea Finn from the RAN, the Dunford brothers, Tommy, Danny, Stephen and Sean. And that's your own composition, Stephen, that we just heard there. So tell us, the Sea Finn, I believe, is it a spot in the Cumbria Mountains?
It is, yeah. It's the highest point. And in folklore, it's where Fionn would sit, Fionn of the Fina. He would sit Fionn. Up there.
Some man.
Yeah.
And have you been up there? How were you inspired? Were you inspired to write the piece looking up at it, or were you actually up there at the time?
It's a beautiful spot. We've hiked it a few times.
Yeah, we have. Yeah,
especially when it's snowing.
It's been a while.
And obviously, the other voice that we're hearing there is Danny Dunford over in the corner here, who's plays the electric bass. And this is, I think, important to the kind of the slightly different sound that you guys have. It is a true mixture of the acoustic and the electric, Danny.
Yeah, I'd have a background in kind of rock music, so I guess when we formed the band, that was kind of the whole idea, to blend a bit of rock and a bit of folk and trad together. And it is an important component to the sound.
We'd also usually have a drum kit as well that has no hi-hats, kind of like all in the floor tom and the bass drum, kind of giving that baron feel. But
he's been reduced to tambourine.
That's the
voice that you just heard there. You see, when you've got four brothers, the voices are so alike.
Yeah.
Tommy was just explaining about the percussion side of things. So yourself, Tommy and Danny, would be the kind of the elect. You're normally here with the drum kit. That's what you would normally have. It gives it more of that rock feel.
Yeah, that oomph from it, like a kind of scratchy vibe.
And you're the two older brothers.
We're the older brothers.
Is it kind of divide and conquer in this case? Is it two against two all the time?
We've clashed swords a few times, but we're good now. We've sorted things out.
Fairly neutral now.
I must say, sitting in the middle of you there is Sean, who's playing the acoustic guitar. And when I asked you, Sean, when I was listening to the sound check earlier on, I said, and do you ever use the electric guitar? You were very clear.
No, I've never played the electric guitar. Me and Stephen have been involved in trad music since we were 10 or 12, and since then I've been playing trad guitar, and I've never really picked up an electric guitar at all.
And any intentions to do so?
No, I'm pretty happy on the acoustic guitar. I like it a good bit more.
I was also interested there, just Stephen, in the midst of that Sea Finn piece that we just heard, that little banjo figure that you repeated around in the middle, all sorts of interesting cross rhythms and things happening there. You're playing
I do play guitar as well. I play a few instruments, so I am influenced by some rock groups and such.
Maybe like Tool and stuff.
Yeah, Tool.
Keep yourself in,
Tool, Primus, stuff like that.
Some weird time signatures going on.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly what was going on in that little section in the middle of it too. And from your point of view then, Tommy, when you've got the full kit and when you've got the full rhythmic thing behind you, how different for you is the sound of the band?
Oh, the sound is, we've been told we sound quite large when we play live as a full band. Like, we usually, I have a cymbal, I bow it with like a cello bow, and like I have these big batons that I hit the floor tom with, and you get like really low, like we kind of like to make like scary, creepy noise a lot of the time. Yeah. Like, and we kind of like create ambience at the start of most of our songs. Like, a lot of the start of our songs would go on for like two more minutes before we actually get into it, just get raving people up, getting ready for, like, you know, drops and stuff like that.
Yeah, because you were very polite, really, with the harmonium today. And I noticed you were, this may have just been the position it's in, I noticed that you were pulling the harmonium open and close with your left hand.
I think it was your right hand.
Can't remember
now.
Because I noticed that over in the corner, Stephen is a left-handed banjo player. And I wondered, if there was two left-handers in the house.
We have two left-handed. Sean and Stephen are left-handed, and me and Danny are right-handed.
Yeah. There you go.
So the two acoustic lads are left-handed, and two rockers.
I just right-handed. Learned how to play the guitar right-handed. Stephen was all convenient. It's more.
I'm the weird one here.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. But that's interesting that the acoustics are left-handed, the electrics are right-handed. Yeah. Somebody can do a psychological and physiological study.
There's a study
on that.
To be done there.
Yeah, absolutely. Dunford, we got the last film we were talking about there, Bacha, with Sheena. Mo Dunford plays Dublin cop in it.
Yeah.
He is a relation of us.
He's always bopping around Dungarvan. It's great to see him. Hopefully we join him for some pints for June Tune Fest this weekend.
Yeah, I know that his intention is to head to the gig. And I don't know which is the more exciting for you, TuneFest, obviously, that playing in front of the home crowd, Tommy, that's exciting. Mm. But then there's Glastonbury after it. I mean, yeah. getting to Glastonbury, no matter what stage you're on, getting to Glastonbury is quite a feat.
We were shocked ourselves, like, when we managed to land Glastonbury. We're super excited to head over and, like, just spread our music and, like, and show the world what we can do, like, you know. And
show the Irish culture as well.
Yeah, are you part of an Irish cultural movement, or is just you're there representing yourselves? What day are you playing in Glastonbury? Do you know which? Do you remember the date of that?
Yeah, we're playing the Thursday in Croissant Nuve, and then we're playing the Saturday in the Underground Piano Bar. Right. You won't find that anywhere, as in, like, that we're playing, or even if you can find the gig itself.
But there'll be people who will seek out the Underground Piano Bar because it's called the Underground Piano Bar.
Yeah, and then we're playing Saturday as well on Croissant Nuve.
Well, that's a fairly that's a fairly hectic schedule.
Toad Hall.
Anyway, you've got three gigs across.
We actually got announced for All Together Now today as well, which is
even better. Crazy. So another local gig for you,
So incredible. Yeah, and that's local Waterford.
And how would you describe? I mean, maybe if you even one of you picks out something specific about TuneFest that stands out for you, that makes it different from other things. I think you were saying something to me, Stephen, before we started, were you?
Well, TuneFest is unreal because, like, I mean, I don't often see many sessions around there on regularly, but we go up to Milltown Malby for the week every year. We've been there for the past 10 years or so, and you catch kind of a similar vibe down in Dungarvan for at least one weekend, which is great to see. Nice to see all the young people getting to play sessions and doing workshops and such.
Loads of stuff going on. Busking competitions, there's gigs on. Talisk are playing, Danu are playing.
Yeah.
And I suppose Dunica Goff would be
the big
mastermind behind it. And the famous Baron player, in the local.
Yeah, so it's fantastic. It's more than just gigs. It's a whole week of delights for people. A song. Who will tell me about the song that we're about to hear? I think it probably half explains itself, but you might tell us a bit more about the Waterford Boys, Danny.
So Waterford Boys, it's basically about a man who emigrates from Ireland, and basically he shows up at a pub. First thing he does is try and get a pint, to drown his sorrows, I guess. And I guess the lyrics will explain themselves. You just have to tune in. Yeah.
That's all. Listen out for the story. It's a ballad. The Waterford Boys from Tommy, Danny, Stephen and Sean Dunford, collectively known as The Ran.
We have met together, I tell ya, from Waterford hither we came. We crossed a big ocean in dark stormy weather. Our pockets were light and our hearts were the same. Sad at leaving all Ireland, where once more on dry land, by the roadside a tavern I chanced for to spy. And as I was melting me pockets I felt, and for the price of a drink I was mortally dry. Far we are the boys of such fun and such eloquence, drinking and dancing and all other joys, corruptions, destructions, diversions and devilment, who's to compare with the Waterford Boys? In the tavern I roll in, the landlord he's strolling, good morrow says he, and says I, if you please, will you give me a bed, and then bring me some bread and a bottle of porter and a small piece of cheese. My bread and cheese ended, I then condescended to take my repose, sure I bade him good night. Well, under me clothes I was trying to doze, first I stuck out me toes and then popped out the light. Well, I wasn't long sleeping when I heard something creeping and gnawing and chawing around the bedpost. My breath I suspended, but the noise never ended, thinks I you have damnable claws for a ghost. Well, to make myself easy, for I felt rather lazy, well, over me head I again pulled me close. Well, Moses, what's that? Sure, a great big jack rat with one lip from the floor jumped right up to me nose. far. We are the boys with such fun and such eloquence, drinking and dancing and all other joys, ferocious destructions, diversions and devilment. Who's to compare with the Waterford boys? Well, I reached for a hobnail and made up a bobtail and wrestled with brass till the clear light of day, when the landlord came in and he said with a grin, for your supper and bed you 5 shillings to pay. 5 shillings for what? Now don't be disgracing yourself, says I to the rogue, if you please. And I can't sleep with these rats, you've the devil's own face, you to charge me 5 shillings for dry bread and cheese. Oh, the landlord went rearing and lifting and tearing, he jumped through the window and he kicked in the door. When he could go no further, he roared me the murder, these rats, they are rating me up by the store. Well, they sleep in me stable, they ate from me table, they've wrestled me dogs and they've killed all me cats. Trot, then, says I, you give me those 5 shillings and I'll tell you a way to get rid of the rats. I will, then, says he, will invite them to supper and dry bread and cheese they before them, be sure. Never mind if they're willing, but charge them 5 shillings and devil the rat, will you ever see more? Far, we are the boys with such fun and such eloquence, drinking and dancing and all other joys, ferocious destructions, diversions and devilment, who's to compare with the Waterford boys? Far, we are the boys with such fun and such eloquence, drinking and dancing and all other joys, ferocious destructions, diversions and devilment, who's to compare with the Waterford boys? Boys, it's such fun and such eloquence, drinking and dancing and all other joys, ferocious destructions, diversions and devilment, who's to compare with the Waterford boys?
The Waterford Boys, performed there by Tommy, Danny, Stephen and Sean Dunford, collectively known as The Ran. And you can catch them live in Grattan Square, Sunday the 22nd June, as part of TuneFest in Dungarvan. Then they'll be at Glastonbury the following week, a couple of gigs there. And then All Together Now has been announced. That's the August Bank Holiday weekend. That's when that will be happening. But you can find out full details of TuneFest on tunefest.ie and all of the upcoming gigs and live events of The Ran on their website, which is theran.com. Kevin Barry's new play, The Cave, opened at the Abbey Theatre on Friday evening. You may remember that I spoke with Kevin and actor Aaron Monaghan on Arena about the play last month. It's the tale of two brothers, Archie and Bopper McRae, played by Tommy Tiernan and Aaron Monaghan. It's set on the side of a mountain in County Sligo and features the two men obsessing about a famous actress on Netflix and going nowhere fast. There's also a Bangar that played by Judith Ruddy, who seems to be the men's only contact with the outside world. Helen Meaney has been to see The Cave and she's with me now in studio. It's Tommy Tiernan, I think, who has the opening lines belonging to Archie. And I guess in some ways it summarises many of the themes in the play. He starts out by saying, or by asking the question, am I writing myself, is the question. And this is after a big, long physical act of opening where he's climbing up and down ladders and doing all sorts of things around this cave. Who are these brothers McRae? How would you describe them, Helen?
I describe them as, I suppose, outsiders, first of all, living rough, really in a bad way, I would say, living rough in a cave outside the town in Sligo, and that is their only home. So they're homeless. They've reached middle age. They're a bit lost. They're together, but each of them, they drive each other mad, and we sort of wonder you know, why they don't separate. But I think what happens, what becomes clear is that they have nowhere else to go. So they've been surviving by sort of petty thieving, but at which they're not very good. They're hapless, really. And they are, they're sort of escaping really into this online fantasy world.
Yeah, it was one of the things that really struck me when I was talking to Kevin Barry and Aaron Monaghan about the piece. You know, in some ways, these two middle-aged men, for want of a better phrase, rural characters living up on the side of a mountain, kind of outside of society. There's nothing unusual in some ways about that, but it was this online presence. And I remember Kevin Barry talking about how important that was in what he wanted to explore in the play. How does it factor in what happens and the sort of action that we're watching? It,
hugely. I mean, it's really interesting that they seem so kind of incompetent in many ways, but they are absolutely determined to get their internet signal. So they're falling over. There's a lot of stage business. They're climbing up ladders, and it's. So there's something really desperate about that.
Yeah.
And because it is really an addiction, possibly you'd say. It's an urge to get away from the pretty miserable life. And it's sort of a factor that has entered our lives so recently,
yeah.
But it has transformed them, and there's the obsession with the soap actress, the Mexican soap
Elvira
actress,
Martinez.
Martinez and Bopper, the Aaron Monaghan is obsessed with her to the point of losing all grasp of reality and is looking for her Instagram posts. And there's a scene where a very carefully, cleverly fake post comes from her as if it's directed to him, and he's transfixed. So there's something quite sad, actually, and a bit pathetic about that. And they're also using the phones in all sorts of other ways, like to record the Archie character is recording what he calls his memoir, which is just kind of rambling notes into the smartphone. And Bopper is singing along to a soundtrack that he finds through desperate measures on a laptop,
yeah.
That one of the stolen laptops that they've got. So it's sort of like they have difficulty distinguishing between what's real and what isn't.
And I suppose that is very much a factor in contemporary life.
And how compulsive it is, and how sort of all encompassing, how you can be just sucked into all of this.
Thinking of, you know, Aaron Monaghan and his facility with any kind of physical acting and clowning, for want of a better description, you know, physical clowning, by that. And then you have Tommy Tiernan as the kind of, you know, the straight-faced comedian a lot of the time.
Yes, yes. The interplay between them is so well matched in terms of their particular differences. So Tommy Tiernan, particularly as it goes on, becomes more still and quieter. He is the slightly more reflective or introspective of the two of them anyway. But that there is great rapport between them as performers. And Aaron Monaghan gets to do the most extravagant, kind of ridiculous, eye-popping, kind of extreme versions of the sort of knockabout.
Yeah.
But they are a double act.
A touch of the vaudevillian type double act. I mean, and Beckett's Tramps are going to come to mind,
Beckett's,
I suppose.
Beckett's Tramps, for sure.
Any other kind of styles that struck you?
Yes, I mean, Aaron Monaghan more recently was seen in, he's been in the Beckett's, but he's also been in the Sean O'Casey one-act plays where he and, say, Marty Ray or Rory Nolan, he's really good at that.
That vaudevillian double act style.
Yes, he is.
There's also a third character played by Judith Roddy. What's her role? And I know there's a relationship there that we won't go too far into, but because that's part of what's given to us as the play goes on. But what does she bring to the stage? What does she bring to the dynamic between the two men?
I think really what she brings is a link to the outside world, because they're so isolated. Well, they're in their own heads, they're on their online, and they're living in a cave. So I mean, so she comes and she's a Garda sergeant. She attempts to move them on. She asks them to leave. They don't leave in a very Godot-like way. They don't leave each other, and they don't leave the cave. She tries to separate them, which she does very briefly. her role really as a Garda sergeant is incredibly ineffectual, actually. And that's really interesting, that she really doesn't do very much to help them, because I think she doesn't know how to help them. Now, it's a quite sketchy role. I mean, I think Judith Roddy plays it very well. She has a lovely kind of wry humour. And she's a bit obsessed, too, with internet conspiracy stuff. So she is not really able to act. And that's very interesting.
As in not able to have an effect
action
on them.
To have agency. And she's obsessed with getting out of the town. And the town that is the hinterland, and it's very important. The town is where the two men are not welcome there anymore. And it's where they grew up. So there's a lot of observation as we go on about a sort of social strata in a small town and general misery. They have a lot of conversations about who's depressed and about suicide, all the depressed men, who are the most depressed women. And then later on, through the sergeant character, Helen, we hear more about their own childhood, about poverty, about alcoholism. There's some very serious
themes.
Material here, but it's treated pretty much on the whole with a very comedic touch, and sometimes that's a problem. There's a slight lack of layers to it. It's all played as very black comedy.
And I mean, if fans of Kevin Barry's writing will know that it often starts in this kind of comic place, but it can go very dark.
Yes, and absolutely. And he can be profane, profound. You know, he can. You know, I think he's a writer who can do almost anything on the page, and he's in control of it. And here, I just felt it was a series of sketches and gags and some very funny lines, but it felt as if it was overstretched and there wasn't enough.
And is that
depth
in the writing or in the direction, do you think?
I think the direction is definitely leaning into the comedy. And I think we lose some sensitivity. But it's also...
That is there in the writing.
It's in the writing in that it is very much jokes about somebody possibly going to kill themselves, jokes about just, you know, endless misery and depression. And I mean, there's a vein of that, as we know, in Irish playwriting and screenwriting. And going back to, say, Pat McCabe or Martin McDonagh, of course, has
brought
it to. But there's something about the tone of that over a long period isn't enough.
What about the design and what we're looking at on stage? Does that feed into that darker side of
it does.
The story?
It's actually strikingly beautiful and bleak. And it's sort of the caves are a very abstract sculptural shape, almost kind of folded in on themselves like an origami piece with a high cliff. And it's very moody. It's quite forbidding as the play goes on, and we think something terrible might happen. And there's beautiful sound design by Sinead Diskin. So it's really the design is carefully matched to the tone, but it is pretty abstract. And then with bits of the broken detritus, the van, all their stolen goods, all kind of littered on the stage in front. So Joanna Parker's design is very good.
So finally, are you recommending this as a piece of theatre?
I'm recommending it for fans of Tommy Tiernan and people who love Kevin Barry's brilliant work. It's not, I think it needs either to be tightened up in terms of pace, but also possibly cut a little bit. But it's worth seeing the performances, yes.
That's The Cave by Kevin Barry. It's at the Abbey Theatre through until the 18th of July. It's also at the Galway International Arts Festival from the 22nd through to the 26th of July. abbeytheatre.ie and giaf.ie for full details. And that is our lot for this Monday evening. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound this evening. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTÉ Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.